This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level, Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus aurelius by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 Satoshis Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working? Can you feel it, Shane?
It's working. I can feel it.
Good. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So I am Lou, and I'm joined by Shane, and welcome to the Freedom Fiends. So what's new and exciting in your world, Shane? What's going on?
Trying to get a new job, actually. I've been working for Amazon over a year now, but it's really hard to get full-time with them, and most of their locations are part-time. So I may actually be looking to go outside of Amazon for employment.
Okay. What sort of things are you looking at? What do you want to be when you grow up?
Well, I like to think I've already grown up in a lot of ways, maybe not all of the possible ways, but I've been had a lot of experience forklift driving. It's what I've done for many, many years, and that's kind of what I'm looking at still, is finding a warehouse or a transportation hub where I can do just that, sit on a forklift and load and unload trucks, basically. It's not necessarily what I want to do when I grow up for like a career or anything, but it will pay the bills in the short term.
Nice. I worked for UPS for a number of years. I wasn't driving a forklift, though. I worked on the inside operation. I started off as a loader and unloader, and that was the packages were loaded in the back of the semi trailers. They're stacked in there and just packed as tight as could possibly be. It's really interesting. It's like a big giant game of Tetris.
Yeah, we get a lot of trucks in like that. Also, they have to be unloaded by hand. Thankfully, we also get a lot of volume on pallets, which is where I come in. And we load and unload pallets, which is what I prefer, is everything that's palletized. I don't like to do the unloading by hand.
Yeah.
And plus, those trucks get pretty hot sometimes.
Yes, very hot. Hot in the summertime and cold in the wintertime. But I remember we'd have some stuff that would be palletized and shrink-wrapped, and the unloaders would have these extending conveyor belts that went into the semi-trailers.
Yes.
And they would have to move the conveyor belt every few minutes to move it forward towards the nose of the trailer. And they just unloaded everything piece by piece, and then it shot out on the conveyor. It went out to the sorter. The sorter sent it out on different conveyors, which went out to the different areas in the building. And yeah, it was pretty heavy duty stuff.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like what we have. I'd say half of our volume is actually done that way, and then the other half is palletized. So yeah, I know exactly what you mean, the conveyor belts and the sorter and all that kind of stuff. We definitely have that at Amazon, lots of that. And Amazon actually likes more of that. They're trying to do away with forklift as much as possible because, you know, safety reasons and whatnot. So
yeah.
I think they're opening a lot of new locations that are strictly piece by piece. So yeah, that's definitely the wave of the future, I guess.
Yeah, the hub that I worked in, we would process between 60 and 100,000 pieces in like a 3.5-4 hour period every Monday through Friday.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like Amazon. It's the same thing. We have like a 4 or 5 hour shift, and they do about 100,000 pieces in one shift.
Yeah, what's really amazing, because this was going out, the way the UPS and FedEx systems and probably the Postal Service, the way that those work is they'll build direct loads out to different regional hubs, like Meadowlands, New Jersey would cover all of New Jersey and the New York City area, and then you'd also have Buffalo and Syracuse that you would build direct loads to, and from there it would filter out into the smaller delivery centers. So
yeah.
Also, places that didn't have a whole lot of volume going to them, like let's say North and South Dakota and a couple others, those might go into a load that goes out to distribute to those states and then to the delivery centers. And Yeah, it was pretty interesting. It was always a surprise at the end of the day that there wasn't a big giant mushroom cloud over the building, because you are sorting that many packages by address, essentially.
Basically, so, yeah, that sounds like the exact method of distribution that Amazon currently uses.
Yeah, so I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I mean, it just defies any sense of logic that it could possibly not wind up being a mushroom cloud and just all messed up and just absolutely off the wall. That's the only way to describe it. But I mean, it worked pretty darn good. So
yeah, it does. It can be pretty chaotic at times, especially our location is very chaotic right now because they opened a new location right next door, and they're taking on about half of our location's volume currently. So we never know what we're going to have from one day to the next. It could be slow. It could be busy. We never really know till we get there.
So how long have you been at Amazon?
I've been at Amazon over 1 year now, just barely over a year.
Okay. So how are you as far as like seniority goes? Would you be able to use that to your benefit to get a full-time position or what?
Yeah, actually, I've been in a few different departments now, and they do have a high turnover rate. I'd say the average employee probably stays about 3 months. So I've seen a lot of people come and go in the time that I've been there. And I actually do head a department now. I head the outbound department for my shift. And so I can use that to my advantage. I deal a lot with logistics and truck drivers and things like that.
Nice. So maybe you won't have to leave Amazon.
Well, maybe not, but I've been holding out for a long time, and it's really hard to get one of their full-time positions. So
yeah, that's how it was at UPS, too. But anyway, yeah. I have some exciting news. I just received word earlier, right before we went on the air, that Brett from School Sucks Podcast will be attending the 6th Annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, which will be held at the Circle Pine Center in Delton, Michigan from June 21st through June 25th. So that's Thursday through Monday again. It's longer and stronger.
Yeah, I love the four-day fest. It's really nice. 4 days and three nights, it's great.
It's even longer than that because you got Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night. So that's four nights right there.
Oh, I guess it is four nights, yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't actually count Monday, I guess, because you're basically just having breakfast and packing up. But it is one heck of a breakfast, by the way.
Yeah. Well, it's four nights in 4 days because it does start on Thursday now.
Right.
So you got all day Thursday, all day Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then you get the partial day on Monday. And then I usually get there on Wednesday with the setup crew.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So
now I'm one of those night owls that likes to stay up late and sleep in the morning. And Monday morning is usually kind of slow going for me, but I have to force myself to get up and have the breakfast and pack up and get ready to go.
Yeah, I managed to pull it off, too. It's not always pretty, but I pull it off.
Yeah.
So, what's new with Bitcoin? What's with this new Bitcoin that's coming out?
Okay. Well, Bitcoin has forked in the past, and they just recently had another fork. The first one created Bitcoin Cash, which is doing fairly well on its own, and there's a new token out this last couple of days called Bitcoin Gold. I'm not really sure of any wallets or exchanges that are supporting it at this point, but I think over the weekend we should see some of those pop up, and anyone who holds Bitcoin will also have an equal amount of Bitcoin Gold as well. It's basically just they took a snapshot of the Bitcoin blockchain and kind of cloned it, and they're using that for the new token. But the new token has a little bit of a technology difference. Supposedly, it has like replay protection, and they have bigger block size. So we'll see if it actually, and it's easier to mine as well. So we'll see if it eventually outpaces Bitcoin in one way or another. But I doubt it's actually going to replace Bitcoin. I don't think anything will actually replace Bitcoin itself.
Okay. So what's going to happen for people to get this new Bitcoin, either the Bitcoin Cash or the Bitcoin Gold, you called it?
Yeah, the new coin is called Bitcoin Gold, and it's abbreviated BTG. And anyone who holds Bitcoin during a fork can claim their tokens on the new chain by, if you control your private keys, you can find a wallet that's compatible with the new coin, and you can use those private keys to claim your new tokens on the new chain. But I would probably suggest making sure that the device you do that on is secure and that you trust the wallet. And if you're really worried about it, you can move your Bitcoin to a new wallet and then use the old private keys to cash in on your new tokens.
Okay. What if you didn't claim your Bitcoin Cash after the last fork? What if you're kind of like, I don't understand this stuff, and you haven't claimed it yet? Can you still claim it? And
yeah,
what happens when you claim it? Do you have to give up your regular Bitcoin to get the Bitcoin Cash and the Bitcoin Gold?
No.
Or what?
No, you don't have to give it up. Basically, every time there's a fork, they just copy the blockchain, and you have the same balance on the new blockchain as you would have on the old one, but it's just in a new token. So, like, for example, Bitcoin Cash, it forked on August 1st, and anything, the balance that you held on August 1st in Bitcoin was also copied over to the new chain. So let's say you had one whole Bitcoin on August 1st, then you would also have one Bitcoin Cash waiting for you as well. And the same now with Bitcoin Gold. However much you held, I think, on the 23rd or the 25th, will also be, you know, basically duplicated on the new chain. So you won't lose your Bitcoins, and you will have new altcoins as well.
Okay. So once again, and I know you kind of touched on it a little bit, what's the best way? Go into some detail. What's the best way to claim your Bitcoin Cash and your Bitcoin Gold and your upcoming Bitcoin BIPs?
There is another fork coming up in November. I think it's scheduled for around the 16th, and that's going to be called SegWit2x, S2x for, or B2x, I think, is going to be the abbreviation. But basically, I use the Bitcoin.com wallet for my Bitcoin Cash. And what I did was I set up a Bitcoin Cash wallet and then just plugged in my private keys and was able to claim my Bitcoin Cash. It's pretty easy, but you want to do it on a device that you trust.
Alrighty. Well, thank you very much for that news we can use. And we will be right back after this trip to the market.
Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
When the final element is used, it's not good only you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed,
buy sheep for sheep on jeep,
and Bitcoin, 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 Bitcoin.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says,
Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, kind of collect them all. Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all. Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all. Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all. Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all.
This is Lou and Shane, and we're going to go back to a story that I started covering last week with Yak Boy. And this comes from Fee, and it's about the Bolshevik Revolution. The full title of it is A Revolution to Always Remember But Never Celebrate. And last week we talked about a British journalist. His name was Gareth Jones, and he reported a little bit too accurately on what life was like in the Soviet Union, and died for his troubles. So the article covered two people, and the second one that we're gonna cover tonight, his name is Boris Nikolaevich Kornfeld. So exactly when Boris Nikolaevich Kornfeld was born, no one seems to know now for sure. We might know nothing of him today were it not for a few photographs and a famous book by a man, for the moment, let me simply refer to him as Mr. X, whose life is he hugely affected and perhaps even helped save. We do know that in the late 1940s, Kornfeld was a prisoner incarcerated at Ekibastus, a notorious forced labor camp in Soviet Siberia. We know that Kornfeld was a doctor by profession and was sometimes ordered to tend to other prisoners. He was Jewish, but was apparently so affected by the faith and stoicism of Christian prisoners in the camp that he converted. He felt a powerful compulsion to tell others about Christianity at great risk to himself. In his famous book, Mr. X writes this about his encounter with Dr. Kornfeld. Following an operation, I am lying in the surgical ward of a camp hospital. I cannot move. I am hot and feverish, but nonetheless my thoughts do not dissolve into delirium, and I am grateful to Dr. Boris Nikolaevich Kornfeld, who is sitting beside my cot and talking to me all evening. The light has been turned out, so it will not hurt my eyes. There is no one else in the ward. Fervently, he tells me the long story of his conversion from Judaism to Christianity. I am astonished at the conviction of the new convert, at the ardor of his words. We know each other very slightly, and he was not the one responsible for my treatment, but there was simply no one here with whom he could share his feelings. He was a gentle and well-mannered person. I could see nothing bad in him, nor did I know anything bad about him. However, I was on guard because Kornfeld has now been living for 2 months inside the hospital barracks without going outside. He had shut himself up in here at his place of work and avoided moving around camp at all. This meant that he was afraid of having his throat cut. In our camp, it had recently become fashionable to cut the throats of stool pigeons. Wow, I guess snitches really do get stitches there. This has an effect, but who could guarantee that only stoolies were getting their throats cut? One prisoner had his throat cut in a clear case of settling a sordid grudge. Therefore, the self-imprisonment of Kornfeld in the hospital did not necessarily prove that he was a stool pigeon. It is already late. The whole hospital is asleep. Kornfeld is finishing his story. I cannot see his face. Through the window came only the scattered reflections of the lights of the perimeter outside. The door from the corridor gleams in a yellow electrical glow, but there is much mystical knowledge in his voice that I shudder. Those were the last words of Boris Kornfeld. Noiselessly, he went into one of the nearby wards and there lay down to sleep. Everyone slept. There was no one with whom he could speak. I went off to sleep myself. I was awakened in the morning by running about and trampling in the corridor. The orderlies were carrying Kornfeld's body to the operating room. He had been dealt 8 blows on the skull with a plasterer's mallet while he slept. He died on the operating table without regaining consciousness. Who was this famous Mr. X who penned those words? None other than Alexander Solzhenitsyn, 10 years a prisoner in what he would later immortalize as the Gulag Archipelago. In the title of one of the greatest literary and historical works of the 20th century, the future Nobel laureate Solzhenitsyn acknowledged that Kornfeld played a key role in his mental and spiritual resolve to endure ghastly circumstances. When the Gulag manuscript was smuggled out and appeared in print in the West in 1973, it blew away whatever was left of the myth of Soviet socialism's workers' paradise. Boris Kornfeld was not just a number. He was like the 80 or 90 or 100 million victims of the great October Socialist Revolution. He was a real human being. He had a name, a family, and ambitions, likes and dislikes, joys and sorrows. Thankfully, he had more than a little decency, too. And we'll be back.
Worms.
And the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Meow.
Freedom Fiends. This is Lou and Shane, and we're going to wrap up this article here. The second half of it was pretty short. To give you a little recap of what was covered, Alexander Solzhenitsyn had written about Boris Kornfeld in his epic writings, the Gulag Archipelago. And to finish up, he says, thankfully, he had more than a little decency, too. He shared truth and inspiration and suffered for it, but we have good reason to believe that in his courage, challenged to the soul of another man, he helped bring an end to a truly evil empire. Gareth Jones would, and this is the gentleman I spoke about last week, Gareth Jones would, I'm quite sure, be very pleased with that outcome. These further words of Solzhenitsyn provide me with an appropriate conclusion. Think about them. Socialism of any type leads to a total destruction of the human spirit and to a leveling of mankind into death. In different places over the years, I have had to prove that socialism, which to many Western thinkers is a sort of kingdom of justice, was in fact full of coercion, a bureaucratic greed and corruption and avarice, and consistent with itself, that socialism cannot be implemented without the aid of coercion. The great socialist revolution was a calamity of the first order. Let us make no excuses for it, ever. And there's a lot of people that do make excuses for the history of socialism.
That's true.
They'll say that, well, that wasn't real socialism. You know, that wasn't socialism. That was Stalinism. That was Leninism. Well, the unfortunate truth, and Leonard Reed, or not Leonard Reed. Yeah, it is Leonard Reed. No, Lawrence Reed. God, why do I keep getting those two confused? I did that last week. But Lawrence Reed touches on this. It's based upon coercion. You can't get to Marxism without Stalinism, Leninism, Maoism. And if you say it wasn't real socialism, and ultimately when you look at the economic calculation problem and the fact that you need coercion without it, it's not real socialism until everybody is starved to death already.
Yeah, and while these things they claim may look good on paper, they're never implemented as intended, and that's part of the problem, is that the implementation is something that's forced on everyone, whereas if it was a truly voluntary society, individuals would have the choice to opt out and do their own thing.
Right. It's really amazing that a lot of people will use this... I think it's a John Adams quote, that our Constitution was made for a truly virtuous people. And I got to tell you, John Adams is probably right below Alexander Hamilton for my least favorite of the founding lawyers.
Yeah.
I don't think that Adams was quite as malicious as Hamilton was. I think that Adams was just a true believer statist, and he felt that this was the best thing on earth, whereas Hamilton was, I see him more as, let's just loot and pillage and call it something else.
Right. Well, I'd like to think that he wasn't as malicious as some of the others, but he, of all people, was responsible for things like the Alien and Sedition Acts and the First Bank of America. So, yeah, I wouldn't put it past him that was perhaps intentional on his part.
Yeah, something that I put out on my Facebook account yesterday, I think it was, before it got zucked today. When you take a look at the founding, by the end of the founding generation, if you take a look at what had happened, if you compare, how exactly did I put it? Oh, King George III would look like Ron Paul in comparison to the founding fathers.
Yeah, by the end of that generation, we saw a lot of things like the Whiskey Rebellion that probably would have been less likely under the king. But
there were three rebellions by the end of 1800 or 1801. You had Shays' Rebellion, which led to Washington coming out of retirement from public life, and it spurred the Constitution so that they could have a central power to crush this nonsense. Because it was okay to freedom really hard back when the crown was in place, but once they got in place, the new central planners took umbrage with people trying to freedom harder than they were allowed to. But you had Shays Rebellion, you had the Whiskey Rebellion, which was over a 25% beverage tax. So people like to compare modern-day presidents to the Founding Fathers, you know, like George Washington and stuff. Well, until Barack Obama sends out troops to crush a tax protest and collect a tax, he would never be a George Washington. Trump either.
Right. Yeah. The Founding Fathers were actually very hypocritical when you examine them in that light. And even Thomas Jefferson himself said that he had abused his power during his time as president. So, I mean, I don't think anyone is safe from the power of the ring.
Exactly. And the third rebellion was Fry's Rebellion. I don't remember all the details on that. I'd have to take a look at it. But that went through 1800 or 1801, something like that. It was pretty short-lived. It wasn't very major. But, well, it was major enough to get noted, but it wasn't, I don't think it had the veracity of the Whiskey Rebellion. Shays Rebellion could probably more accurately be called Shays Complaining, because it wasn't really a rebellion. It was just named a rebellion.
There was
a little bit of violence. There's a little bit of violence that went with it, but not a heck of a lot. I think more people got paper cuts from writing arrest warrants than they got shot.
Yeah.
But going back to the Adams quote, where he talks about that our Constitution is made only for virtuous people, these people will say, well, we can't have freedom because people are not virtuous, yet they expect the people that go into public office to be, you know, the politicians, the leaders, the masters, the rulers, they expect them to be virtuous for some reason.
Yeah. I don't think that they should have put so much trust in such people, because that kind of office and that kind of power only attracts the corruptible. So, yeah.
Well, I really think that a lot of it comes from the Hobbesian point of view, that the heart of man is wicked, and that in the absence of government, life is short, nasty, and brutish, like Michael Dean.
Wow.
That's his joke, by the way. So.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, but I mean, Hobbes was operating on the best limited information that he had available to him in the 17th century. Not that there was great access to information or anything else. And here's something for you. If life was tough back then, well, it didn't matter if there was a government or not, because you didn't have the indoor plumbing like you have today. You didn't have the same type of heating. You didn't have furnaces. You didn't have electricity. You didn't have air conditioning. You didn't have Reynolds wrap and refrigerators. You know, it didn't matter if you were the king or a peasant. When you go out hunting, if you didn't kill an animal for dinner, you didn't have meat that night. It didn't matter who it was. You know, I mean, granted, the king would have several hunters that he could send out, probably, and maybe he had some livestock going, but I mean, ultimately, everybody suffered from the same problems. And, you know, today, even the working poor can save up money and fly to Cancun for a long weekend, because I mean, they get like Spirit Airlines with these dirt cheap ticket prices. You got these different hotels there. They're always doing these little special offers and everything. So, this can be done. The poor can go to Cancun for the weekend. It's not always the most glamorous, but they can do that. Now, granted, they can't get on a private jet like the rich people can, but they still can go to Cancun for the weekend. But the thing is, nobody had these things available to them back in the 17th century. Life sucked for everybody. It didn't matter, prince or pauper. It sucked for everybody. And for people to bemoan this stuff, why do you think nobody complained about poverty back in those days? Everybody was in poverty. There was no way to know wealth.
Right. I think it was more obvious back then that poverty was kind of the default state, and then capitalism is what, you know, lifts you up from that default.
Yeah, it's the starting point, because without somebody going out and producing these different things, without somebody growing all these vegetables, you can't go to a supermarket. Without somebody building a supermarket, you can't go to a supermarket. And you did, you know, this capital did not exist for things to look like they do today. It's the culmination of all these accomplishments of humanity. You know, both, and it winds up being a collective accomplishment through individual efforts and accomplishments, because it's a compounding. It's like compound interest, except it's compound accomplishment.
Right. Let them eat cake.
Yeah. Yeah. now you can go to the bakery and get all sorts of cakes.
Yeah. Even poor people can have cake now.
Yeah. But Hobbes also talked about war was. The nature of man is perpetual war. Wow, thank God governments have solved that problem. aren't you really happy that the U.S. has stopped this Hobbesian nightmare of perpetual war from existing?
If only they could. I don't believe that's an actual power that they can refrain from using.
Because as the world's last-ish superpower, you know, Doesn't the U.S. government claim responsibility for maintaining world peace and everything else? And, you know, is it just really great that this human nature of war has been completely crushed by governments? Oh, wait a minute. How on earth do you have long-lasting perpetual war without government? And how do you fund this? How do you conscript all these people? And how does this happen?
Through coercion.
So I personally think that with the founding fathers and this idea of, well, and I'm not talking about the ones that just wanted to loot and pillage like Hamilton, Morris, Washington, and those guys, most of the Federalists. I'm talking about the people that bought into the Hobbesian notion of, oh, we have to have government, or the Rousseauian social contract nonsense. I think a lot of this comes from, one, deification of the state, meaning the God that justifies the legitimacy of governments and in states and everything else. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also this belief in central planning, which is kind of like intelligent design for people in the religion of statism.
Yeah. And on people defer their own authority to a central collective.
Yeah, and on the seventh day, he created roads. We'll be back.
Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Biptunia, music for the drive to Alpha Centauri. Biptunia's influences are Gary Numan, Brian Eno, Pink Floyd, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, Grateful Dead, Frank Zappa, Robert Fripp, Blondie, Kraftwerk, and Dead Kennedys. Biptunia styles are trip-hop, rock, pop, glam, industrial, ambient, jazz, and space. Plus, it's got cats and is covered by the BIPCOT NoGov license. You can download Biptunia's music free. Go to biptunia.com. That's BIPTUNIA. Bravo, India, Papa, Tango, Uniform, November, India, Alpha. Biptunia.com.
That article from Lawrence Reed and Fee about why the Bolshevik Revolution should be remembered but not celebrated, and kind of went off on a diatribe of the whole "it's not real socialism," and you can always depend on somebody who is ideologically driven and who loves the idea of something to always point to the failures and say, well, that wasn't that. And in some cases, you could be correct. But ultimately, this notion that you can reform things and turn them into something that they can't possibly be is just absolutely ridiculous. It's like all the people talking about, well, it's not socialism, it's democratic socialism. No, it's still socialism. And you could take a pig into a dressing room and have it put on all kinds of different costumes, but it's still a pig underneath.
Yeah.
And I see this a lot with all these people that they talk about, oh, end the Fed. All we got to do is get rid of the Federal Reserve and everything's going to be fine. You know, the Founding Fathers never would have tolerated this thing. You know, well, okay, Robert Morris, the original bankster, he wouldn't have tolerated it. Really?
Alexander Hamilton? Absolutely, he would have.
John Adams, George Washington. He has created two central banks. You know, mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve is the fourth central bank in American history and the third in U.S. history. The first one was created before during the War for American Independence, but it was created then, and that was by the Founding Fathers. And then there was one right afterwards, also created by the Founding Fathers. So yeah. When people talk about, well, you know, we get rid of the Federal Reserve, we're back to the Constitution. Oh, okay. What Constitution? The one that either created the government that exists today or the one that was powerless to prevent it? Which Constitution is it? Or is it both?
Right.
So all these reformers, I think the best way of describing it is they have this notion, and I think of... I don't really have the best way to lead up to this, but it's like let's say you're a designer of tires and wheels and everything, and your boss says, "Look, this wheel that we have, this square wheel, it's not working. So you could do whatever you want to it. You could change the width. You can make it wider. You can make it narrower. You could go as wide as you want or as narrow as you want. You could change the color. You could put." You know, you could change the tread of the tire. You could do anything that you want to improve this wheel. But the one thing that you must keep the same is it must remain square.
Yep, that's a good analogy.
That's what the reformers are doing. They're taking the square wheel of socialism. They're taking the square wheel of government and trying to change it around to, you know, have a different width, have a different tread, have, you know, change the words on the outside, the brand name of it, but it's still square. Government and socialism is square.
It sure is. It's not very hip, is it?
No. And this is the Freedom Fiends where the hip meets a hip replacement, because most of us are old here.
Well,
when you go from cocaine to lidocaine, that's when you can be a fiend, although I never did cocaine. But yeah, it's just really amazing that people will try and redo the same thing over and over again. It's like a poo sandwich, and they're just coming up with different recipes to make it, and it's got the same ingredients. I don't see why people keep clinging to this ideology and looking for ways to justify it. It doesn't matter if it's the constitutional republic, democracy, or socialism, communism. You know, here's one. I was explaining to somebody about how welfare programs generally cause more harm than good, and how they provide disincentives. And I went through in excruciating detail, and I used the Socratic method and everything. Say, okay, so. Do you see where this causes this problem here? Yes, I do. That's horrible. That should not happen. And at the end, the only response was when I said, so do you see how all this stuff doesn't work and how it causes more problems than it solves? And that person says, I see all that, but who's going to take care of the poor? We have to do something. It's like, did everything just fall out of your ears? Everything that you agreed to? I mean, this person even came up with some points. Yeah, went back to that. It's like the chorus of a song that you can't get out of your head.
Yeah, it's hard to break the deck.
Statism is a chorus of a song you can't get out of your head. That might be tonight's show title or subtitle.
Sounds good to me.
Worms. We'll be right back.
The central scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Trigger warning. Welcome back to the Freedom Fiends Variety Hour, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's Low Orbit Ion Cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite LibPair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. And as always, the Freedom Fiends is covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. This allows reuse by anyone except governments and government agents. To learn more, go to BIPCOT.org. And speaking of trigger warnings, I believe Lou posted earlier today, he said, under Obama, right-wingers bought more guns, but under Trump, lefties that had never even touched a gun have bought their very first guns and fired them. So who's the real gun salesman?
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I saw that article posted in a couple places, and then that little video on Now This, I think, is the Facebook page.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting that a number of LGBTQRST alphabet, I don't know. But anyway, bunch of gays, lesbians, and stuff like that have taken up buying arms, and they've started shooting clubs, and they're learning how to shoot and everything else. And they this is the part that I disagree with. They're arming up to defend themselves against conservatives, and I see them in like. Conservatives are status collectivists, commies, you know, just like they
they're
are.
Just socialists of a different flavor. Yeah.
They're the reflection of in the mirror of the left wing commies. But anyway, it's real interesting because these people aren't really their enemy. You know, the conservative. And as much as I hate the way that they vote, and I hate the way that they vote as much as I hate the way that liberals vote, or any other voter for that matter. But yeah, most conservatives don't really care about gays and everything else, and they're not going to go out and start having lynching, hunting parties, and all this other stuff. Now, if you throw in different factions of the alt-right, then, yeah, I can understand that. But I don't think that the alt-right is really that crazy over sexual orientation. And I'm pretty sure there's a fair amount of sexual abnormalities that run through that group anyway, but
the conservatives have their own version of LGB. I believe it stands for Liberty, Guns, and Beer.
Limited Liberty. Keep in mind that they're staunch advocates of limited liberty. But anyway, yeah, it's really interesting, and I generally think that anybody that buys guns and learns how to use them, I generally consider that to be a good thing, because there's self-defense doesn't just apply to the hordes of evil conservatives that are gonna come conserve them or whatever, and once again, I mm-hmm. think that's a nonsense thing. Just like I think it's nonsense when conservatives say those liberals are gonna come liberal us, and whatever. State right. is going to state. But,
well, I think it's good to see them taking their responsibility for their own self-defense rather than collectivizing it.
Yeah, I think what they're realizing, and I haven't heard any of them talk about this, and it'd probably be interesting to sit down and chat with a bunch of them, do like a little focus group or something like that. Maybe I could record it or something like that. But I wonder if their concern is they have a lack of trust in the police to protect them because of their orientation, or if it's a lack of faith in police to protect them, period.
Right. But then they don't recognize the cognitive dissonance in some of their own views, where they will be like, oh, guns are bad, But then they say only cops should have guns, you know?
Yeah.
Or cops are bad, but they're the only ones who should have guns.
Yeah, the cops are racist, so the only ones that should have guns are the racists.
Exactly.
But, yeah, it's I'd really be curious to find out about that. Now, there was one guy, I can't remember what his name was. I saw the video earlier today, and I posted, but I didn't do a whole lot of thinking on it because I figured it would be part of the show or anything like that. But he says, oh, well, we don't want an arms race. I'm thinking to myself, we? Don't mouse pocket them, bro.
Yeah, who is we? Do you have a mouse in your pocket?
Yeah. Now, the whole thing of violence begets violence, well, yeah, it does, but being prepared to repel violence, you know, repelling violence would be violence begetting violence. Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, the fact that you're prepared to repel violence doesn't guarantee that violence is going to happen. And you know what? If you're not prepared to repel violence, then that's not going to stop violence from happening either.
No.
But I think that if this group starts arming themselves up and getting trained and knowing what they're doing, and they're able to defend themselves against all sorts of threats, be it the scumbag home invader that is coming to burglarize them, or if it is somebody that hates them because they're different, I think that's a good thing.
Yep. And that does actually remind me of one of the articles we were planning on maybe using tonight. And I could just go into this, I guess. This article is titled Police Pleasantly Surprised to Learn Man They Shot Was Armed. And says this is out of Lexington, Kentucky, and it goes on to say, following a pedestrian stop Monday night during which they fired their weapons on a suspicious individual, patrol officers of the Fayette County Police Department were pleasantly surprised to discover that the man they shot was armed, sources confirmed. Quote, well, what do you know? He really was carrying a gun, said Officer Dustin Hayes, smiling upon finding a 9mm pistol on the body of the 23-year-old individual shortly after the policeman and his partner discharged their firearms a total of 19 times. Quote, I honestly had no idea he had a handgun, so it's pretty great to find one right there tucked into his waistband. This makes the rest of our week a whole lot easier, unquote. Officers said they were further relieved after discovering the man had a petty theft charge on his record, ensuring they were 100% off the hook. Now, I didn't mention the source of this article because it is from The Onion, so I didn't want to unbury that lead for effect.
Yeah, when The Onion hits reality harder than the, you know, real news, when fake news is more accurate than real news, makes you wonder what the real fake news is.
Right.
But going back to the previous story about the LGBT whatever, getting armed up, do you shoot?
I do, actually.
Okay, how often do you shoot? And what's
not very often.
Shooting?
Well, okay. I would say my purpose for doing so in the past was more self-defense. I don't currently own a firearm for various reasons, but I do plan on, you know, purchasing one when I can do so.
They didn't sink to the bottom of a lake in a voting accident, did they?
Your guns? No, they didn't. No.
Okay. So have you ever been a participant in like a league, like handgun league, rifle, trapping, skeet, anything like that?
Well, I did actually. Okay, so I was raised with guns, and I probably learned to shoot at around the age of 6 years old. My parents and grandparents taught me at a really young age, and I did also accompany my stepfather on his league when he would go, and he used to shoot handguns in a league, and he was really good at it. I was actually impressed. His groupings were amazing. He could group all his shots in the 10 area.
Yeah. One of the things, because my story is kind of similar. I grew up shooting pretty young, too. Maybe, possibly a little, probably about the same age as you, around six. But I remember having BB guns and air rifle, you know, pellet guns growing up. And I lived in the city where you couldn't fire a 22 or anything like that. But I mean, back in those days, if you lived out in the country, it was nothing for a kid to have a 22 and go out in the woods and plink.
We did start out with BB guns and pellet rifles, but I did eventually have a 22 rifle for chipmunks and stuff like that, probably at around the age of 10 or 12.
Well, I tell you what, once I was able to hit the target and start to get good at it, that was when I really appreciated shooting. And I remember in the backyard there was a bird feeder on a metal pole, and I would shoot at the pole that supported the bird feeder, and you get this ting every time it hit, and it really made my day to go like 10, 15 times in a row of hitting that pole and hearing that ting. And then when I was using targets, you know, to hit that bullseye. Now, granted, my first BB gun was like a Red Ryder, and once it got out about 50 feet or so, you could see the BB flying through the air, and you could see how it dropped.
You so could see the amount that it dropped. You'd have to aim high. Yeah.
Yeah, so you'd have to adjust your elevation there.
Yeah, my grandpa lived in the country, and I used to go shooting at his place. And I started out with BB guns, and he would hang little metal targets from the trees and stuff. But then eventually, you know, once I got the 22 rifle, he had like he set up kind of like a pile of railroad ties, you know, to shoot into. And we had cans and everything set up there. And I remember one time I knocked all the cans over with one shot, but it's because I hit the board that they were all sitting on.
Yeah, but I tell you what, as a kid, being able to hit the bullseye and get like a really good score on paper, and that just set me up towards my enjoyment of shooting later on. And a number of years ago, I belonged to a sportsman's club in the area where I was living, and they had handgun leagues. So they had a regular bullseye handgun league, and then I also participated in the action plates. Have you ever done those?
No, actually, I haven't.
Okay. You have 6-inch and 8-inch metal plates, and when you shoot them, they knock over. And then there's a string that you can pull, and they'll come back up. But anyway, the 6-inch is for rim fire, 22 caliber, and then the 8-inch is for center fire. And it's really blessed. It's a timed event. So you got 6 plates, and they start you hear the beep of the timer go, and that's when you take your first shot. When you do that, and you go through all 6 of them as fast as you can, so they'll score for time and for accuracy. And it's really a sense of accomplishment to be able to hit like all 6 of them, or to do a perfect score. You know, to where from all the different stations you hit all 6 each time, or if you're shooting trap and the difference between trap and skeet. When you're shooting trap goes away from you. And there's only 5 stations, but with skeet, there's maybe 10 stations, and sometimes they're coming towards you or going away from you. It's or going in front of you. But when you shoot your first perfect line of trap or skeet, and that's a sense of accomplishment right there, and that's one of the joys of shooting. We'll be back.
Wow.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Are you a political activist who does things that the government might not like? Then this free ebook may save your life. RATS is your guide to protecting yourself against snitches, informers, informants, agents provocateur, narcs, finks, and similar vermin. RATS was written by OG libertarian Claire Wolfe. RATS is a short book, easy to read, and available free in many formats. Download RATS free at rats-nosnitch.com. That's rats-nosnitch.com.
All right, we're back. This is the Freedom Fiends, and I'm here with
Back,
and I'm Shane.
We're back.
And I think last hour we mentioned a little bit about cryptocurrencies and blockchains. But cryptocurrency is not the only use for blockchain technology. I did find an article on futurism.com that says MIT has started issuing diplomas using blockchain technology. It says blockchain technology is proving to offer major advantages beyond its well-known applications in the sphere of cryptocurrency. A new app allows MIT graduates to prove ownership of their degree using the digital ledger. Digital diploma with blockchain. Since the school's inception, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology has issued paper diplomas to over 200,000 students. But this summer, a pilot program saw 111 graduates receive their credentials via a specially developed app, in addition to traditional means. The BlockCerts wallet app was developed by Learning Machine in conjunction with the MIT Registrar's Office. It uses blockchain technology to give graduates easy access to verifiable, tamper-proof versions of their diplomas that they can share with potential employers. Quote, MIT has issued official records in a format that can exist even if the institution goes away, even if we go away as a vendor, unquote, said Learning Machine CEO Chris Jaggers in a press release. People can own and use their official records, which is a fundamental shift. BlockCert's wallet uses the same implementation of blockchain that underpins Bitcoin to verify the legitimacy of students' credentials. When an individual downloads the app, a pair of public and private keys are generated, and a one-way hash is added to the blockchain. The student's public key is inscribed into the digital copy of the diploma, and the app has access to the private key for the purposes of proving ownership. When someone wants to check that the diploma is legitimate, they can access a web portal where they can paste a link or upload the digital file and receive confirmation of its owner's identity, which is instantaneous and free of charge. Beyond Bitcoin, blockchain rose to prominence because of its key role in the cryptocurrency boom. However, we're already seeing the technology make a huge difference in all kinds of different applications. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are looking into ways that blockchain could be used to handle the fallout from major epidemics. Airline companies are figuring out how to use a digital ledger to keep track of maintenance and repairs across the breadth of their fleet across the globe. And the media industry could be completely transformed by the technology's potential to improve access to content for paying customers. As trust in blockchain grows, we're starting to see major institutions test the waters. China is considering whether it could be used to collect taxes, while in the U.S., there are calls for it to be implemented to offer improvements to the State Department. Wherever there's a need to keep an indisputable record of an action that can be linked to an individual, blockchain can lend a hand. Many would point to cryptocurrency as one of the most important technological advances in recent years, but the technology that underpins it might end up having a greater overall effect, simply based on the scope of its usage. And it does say here, several members of the Futurism team, including the editors of this piece, are personal investors in a number of cryptocurrency markets. Their personal investment perspectives have no impact on editorial content. Now, I believe that's a disclaimer that they had to add, but I do see blockchain as the wave of the future, and the applications are endless, basically.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I saw a story not too long ago, well, within the past year at least, about I think a country in Eastern Europe, so maybe one of the former Soviet satellite states, but I guess they're talking about using blockchain technology to record deeds and for their record keeping, which Absolutely. Is kind of strange, being that blockchains can't be tampered with, because it doesn't seem like a government would want to really nail things down and not have them be wishy-washy or arbitrary.
Exactly. Yeah. And another thing that I think that wasn't mentioned in the article was the possibility of smart contracts. They can use the blockchain to do contracts as well. So I think that's something that's very promising.
Yeah, and there's a lot of possibility for it. It's really amazing, this new technology that's out there. And this is one of these other things, that Hobbes, we talked about Hobbes in the previous hour, him and Rousseau and all these other great philosophers. They were working with the best knowledge that they had available to them in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. So it's really amazing that technology has gone and just in the past 20 years destroyed ideas that were cutting edge 20 years before.
Yep.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts. Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is Michael W. Dean's novel from the year 2000.
It's entirely fictional.
Allegedly.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is a glorious story about a low-rent post-punk rock star, Cash Newman. Cash Newman is entirely made up.
Not a guarantee.
And is not based on any particular person.
Not a guarantee.
Cash Newman has lots of fun with strange ladies and with the party favors.
Don't try this at home.
And he hangs out with people who commit 3 felonies a page.
But that's none of my business.
It's all in good fun. And at the same time, it's kind of deep. But always spunky. Michael recently updated the book to a much better version. He released it as a paperback and for the first time on Kindle. As with this and all Freedom Fiends related things, please rate and review. Get Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women now on Amazon or at michaelwdean.com.
For entertainment purposes only.
Meow.
Woof. Freedom Fiends. We're back. This is Lou, and I'm speaking with Shane. And we're going to switch it over now to a story from the Chicago Tribune. It's a very long story, so we're barely going to be able to touch on it, I suspect, because I don't think we're going to do the whole last two segments on it. But anyway, this is titled, A Landscaper's Hire American Plan Ended with Bringing in Mexican Workers to Finish a Job. And this was Wednesday, October 20. No. Okay, this was from October 6th. So I was looking at today's date on there. But anyway, the first day on the job for 39 new hires at Jesus Chuy Medrano's landscaping firm started as soon as they stumbled off the bus in the early morning, groggy and stiff from the 13-hour trip from the Mexico border. Ready to work, Medrano joked in Spanish before the men had a chance to use the bathroom or eat breakfast. The 63-year-old grandfather, wearing a cowboy hat, stuffed his hands into the pockets of his jeans and grinned. Medrano, founder and owner of Coquel Landscape, has spent more than $32,000 recruiting and securing visas for the Mexican migrants. After scrambling to find any American willing to do back-breaking work under the Colorado sun. With this crew's arrival, he thought, the season might be salvaged after all. And have you had a chance to read the entire story yet, Shane?
I did, yeah.
It's really amazing. Something that's interesting is this guy, Medrano, started off as a migrant worker coming to the U.S., and now he's like a legal resident or something like that. But he started off sneaking into the country and then also doing the visa and everything else. But he was a migrant worker coming up to pick fruit and all this other stuff and do landscaping, whatever. And he winds up owning this company now. So, isn't that what we're told the American dream is? Is that you come
Absolutely.
Here and you're able to make something of yourself and build something? So, yeah, really interesting. But anyway, The plan that he had was to try and hire American workers, and the reason for that was because Congress and Trump were messing around with the immigration stuff, and of course they're doing the old, they're stealing jobs from American workers, they took our jobs, and it turns out that no, that's really not what's happening, but going back to the story, in Coquel's early years, Medrano said he gave work to undocumented immigrants just as work had once been offered to him. But he later decided that it was not worth risking his business by breaking the law. That's when he turned to the H-2B visa program, initially recruiting family and friends in Mexico. Medrano hired his first crew of 9 migrant workers in 1997. As his company grew, the number of H-2B workers expanded to 160, accounting for 40% of Coquel's total employees the past few years. Those guys, without pushing them, do the work of 1.5 people already here, he said. But it started bothering me that I was relying so much on them. I know one day we weren't going to get them, and that was this year. Medrano said he went to great lengths this summer to recruit Americans to mow lawns, plant trees, and fix sprinklers. He put up a digital billboard over the highway that flashed, "We're hiring," in Spanish and English. He interviewed anyone who walked in. We hope they're breathing and they have a pulse and we hire them, he said. We raise the hourly wage for unskilled laborers to $13.95, 50% more than Colorado's minimum wage. $14 an hour is not bad. I mean, that's a pretty fairly decent wage up here, where I live.
Yeah. Same here.
Dare I even say it's a livable wage? But anyway, he raised the hourly wage for unskilled workers to $13.95 per hour. He stopped firing workers for absenteeism, including a foreman who went AWOL during a two-week drinking binge. We hired more women, allowing mothers to work just the hours their children are in school, as well as high school and college students on summer break. My computer is going slow here. And still, he was short-staffed. Some showed up to orientation to say, "I'm not doing that for $14 an hour." Wow, can you imagine that? And what's really interesting is all these people who say that if you offer Americans $14 an hour, or if they fight for $15, you know, that they'll do this work for that type of money.
Right. Yeah.
So you're gonna have to jump in here because my computer's freezing up. This is okay. The second computer.
All right. So let's see here. Okay, so yeah, he was still short-staffed because he couldn't get enough Americans to actually do these jobs. And so he would always try to, you know, fill the jobs with Americans, but then he wouldn't get enough. And so he would, you know, be forced to, you know, use migrants. But like they said, the Congress recently, I think, reduced the number of migrants from 85,000 to 66,000 or so. And that made it, you know, really difficult. It says here, businesses would have a better luck attracting American workers if they offered competitive wages. Medrano says he paid as much as his customers could support, with entry-level wages hovering at the industry state average. But he said, "I would drive myself out of the market." Quality control dropped this summer because supervisors had to stop overseeing and pitch in. Customers complained of dry spots on lawns where the sprinkler system was not reaching. They grew angry over how long it took the smaller crews to complete each job, and competitors began to poach. Coca-Cola lost $1.7 million in contracts. Then the Trump administration, after heavy industry lobbying, made more visas available. Coca-Cola had to submit paperwork showing that the company would suffer permanent irreparable harm without hiring migrants. The company's request was approved within 2 weeks, and Medrano was on his way to Mexico to meet the workers. It's like a little Band-Aid, Medrano said. And then it talks about a father of three who was really excited to get the phone call from Coca-Cola. And even though it required a 25-hour bus journey from his home near Mexico City to Ciudad Juarez, where he would spend Ciudad Juarez.
This story here is actually heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is actually, because a lot of these people have to leave their families behind, their wives and daughters, and spend half the year in the United States. Says the uncertainty weighs heavily, he said, when he reached Ciudad Juarez. And I think it also weighs heavily for the company not to be sure whether we are going to be able to come or not. Espinoza had been a taxi driver until April when his cab was stolen. He drove school buses until July when school ended, and then he got a maintenance job. But he can't make ends meet. Yeah. But he can't make ends meet on $10 a day. So he came with his 66-year-old father, Adalberto Espinoza, whose passport is filled with guest worker visas from previous stints at Colorado landscaping companies and a Maine meatpacking plant. So this would be their fourth season with Coca. On their first day, Espinoza's gathered with other workers in the hotel's fountain courtyard as if assembling for a reunion. All had worked for Coca-Cola before and felt a mixture of luck at being selected, guilt that the other former colleagues were not, and sadness at the prospect of missing their children's first days of school. "You're happy when you get the call, but as it nears when you have to leave, you don't want the day to arrive," Ramiro Espinoza said. That night, Espinoza discovered a letter that his 9-year-old daughter, Natalia, had tucked into his suitcase. On a piece of paper torn from a spiral notebook, she had written in Spanish in rounded print, "I wish that poverty would not fall upon us so much. I'm not saying this because I want to be rich, but it's that I don't want you to go to the U.S. and be so far from me and the family." Espinoza walked out to the patio and wept. "They are an engine," he said, of his wife and daughters. "Behind every one of us, there are little ones who depend on us, emotionally as well as economically. We live half our lives over there and half our lives over here."
Yeah. So I want to talk about a couple things here. One, this is an example of Schrodinger's immigrant, the immigrant that is both simultaneously taking your gerb as well as sucking up the welfare benefits. This is just absolutely ridiculous, and particularly for those of you that have read the entire article or are going to read the entire article after seeing this, it's really interesting because there's this ideology of immigrants are taking jobs that Americans would be working, and what we've seen here, and I could tell you this from other experience. Sure, it's anecdotal evidence and not hard science data and all this other nonsense, but Americans aren't going to do this type of work. They don't want to work that hard. And, you know, maybe the time has come to where there's enough easy work out there that people have become conditioned to not accept this. But folks down in Mexico where poverty is they're still at the starting point. Now, granted, a lot of the problems in Mexico come from the government and the corruption, and it is really quite socialistic down there. But those people are still living in that time frame. It's like I mentioned earlier, nobody complained about poverty in the 17th century because everybody was in poverty. Even the wealthy were impoverished because they couldn't do anything with that money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most Americans don't realize how easy they have it here, and I've noticed that a lot of, like, say, migrants and first generation Americans are the ones who typically realize the American dream because they're willing to work for it.
Yeah, and most people aren't. And granted, the school systems which promote the steak dinners are going to fall from the sky nonsense, because that's really what a lot of the socialists and communists type stuff comes from, the social justice nonsense, this whole redistribution of wealth. Well, wealth can't be redistributed until it's been created. So it's not really redistribution of wealth, because wealth isn't distributed in the first place. It's created, and it's created by producing stuff. You can have a politically connected crony capitalist welfare parasite that if they don't produce any products, the best that they're going to hope for is getting their welfare payment from the government, which makes them no different from a food stamp recipient. But I mean, without even if they use legislation and regulation to cripple their competition, they still have to actually do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if they don't produce anything, then there's nothing to redistribute.
Yeah, and this whole notion that things are going to come into existence because politicians or somebody declares it to exist is nonsense. No, healthcare is not going to get cheaper because the politicians scribble words on paper. No, it gets cheaper when you have innovations and you have more providers, when the supply and demand curves are in line with each other. But people don't understand that.
If we can't all be rich, let's be equally poor.
Warm.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Thank you for being a fiend. You may know the show is Triggerweens. We're saying worms and your new bigger buttons on. And if you threw a party and invited every yak you knew, you would see we'd still follow the NAP, and we're covered by Bipcot. Thank you for being a fiend.
the Freedom Fiends, and I'm here with Lou, and I'm still Shane, as usual.
So, yeah, real interesting. Well, before we go on to the next story, going back to the Chicago Tribune story of the guy out in Colorado that tried to hire American workers. Well, he had to hire American workers because the government says, well, you can't do that. And regarding the restrictions on hiring migrants and everything, because of the ideology of keeping Mexicans out, keeping Mexicans from stealing the jobs that Americans won't do, this guy's business really suffered quite a bit. He lost an awful lot of money. The vast majority of the year, the customers were being underserved or served very very low quality product of people not going and doing the job, and quite frankly, this whole notion it's kind of like socialism and constitutionalism of I have this ideology, I have this belief of this is how things are going to be or how they should be, and dag nabbit, I'm going to make all the rules declaring that it is this way, and then reality comes and hits them in the face, and they find out that no, it doesn't work that way. Healthcare didn't get cheaper because politicians scribble words on paper. So, I believe a lot of them felt that healthcare was going to get cheaper, you know, because most of them are economically illiterate. I do believe that they had every intention of helping things, but they did the opposite. They didn't help. They made things worse. And it doesn't matter if it's the Obama administration or the Trump administration. All this intervention, it's like Ludwig von Mises said, each new intervention is an attempt to deal with the unintended consequences of the previous interventions. Quit screwing stuff up. So, anyway.
Worms.
Let's go on to some redemption in the third act. This final story here comes from 22words.com, and funny graphs show correlation between completely unrelated stats. And it's really interesting because people will use these graphs. Somebody used the supply and demand curve to justify the notion that predatory pricing would work. And everything else, he says, look, here's a graph to prove it. I'm like, oh, Jesus, for meowing out loud. But, it's really funny. First one here is it shows that the divorce rate in Maine has a very strong correlation with the per capita consumption of margarine through the United States. So apparently when people are eating more margarine, and I prefer butter myself, when more people are eating margarine, the divorce rate in Maine goes up.
Coincidence?
I think not.
or maybe it is just a coincidence.
Or maybe it is. And they're putting something in the margarine as turning the couples divorced. But anyway, the number of people who died by becoming tangled in their bed sheets is
correlates.
Affected. It causes increased revenue of skiing facilities.
Or correlates skiing, with the increased revenue.
Yeah, but... Does it cause the ski facilities to increase their revenue, or does the revenue cause more people to be tangled in their bed sheets and get killed?
Probably neither.
Are you sure?
I'm not certain, but I can't prove a causational relationship between those two statistics.
Okay, what else we got here?
Okay, well, we have U.S. crude oil imports from Norway correlates with drivers killed in collisions with railway trains.
So does that mean that the gasoline made from Norwegian oil draws people to trains and then it causes the cars to stop on the tracks?
Maybe we're importing so much oil that we need more trains and it interferes with the traffic. I don't know. Highly unlikely.
Okay, Miss America and murder. The age of Miss America correlates with murders by steam, hot vapors, and hot objects. So apparently, the older Miss America is, the more people die from, like, steam irons and stuff like that.
Seems unlikely.
Are you sure?
Well, I mean, statistics don't lie.
that's the problem with using statistics, but... 9 of 11 people think that the Freedom Fiends is just absolutely awesome. Thanks for coming on tonight, Shane. And thanks to everybody for listening. For more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com.
Worms.